Hello and welcome to this week's Key Voices. I'm Caroline Doherty. We will no longer be including the week's headlines in our podcasts, but I encourage you to visit resources.thekeysupport.com/newsbriefing and sign up for our news briefing, a weekly education sector roundup delivered to your inbox every Friday. Today, I'm joined by my colleague, Bethany Eady, content producer, and we are delighted to have Dr. Emma Kell with us, educator and author of How to Survive in Teaching Without Imploding, Exploding, or Walking Away. So, welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Emma, can you just tell us a little bit about you and what prompted you to write the book?
So I'm Emma. I've been teaching for over two decades now, which makes me sound very old. One day I was a bit restless. I'm one of these people who's always looking for the next thing, always kind of thinking about, never very settled, always a restless child. I was doing a job and it was going really well. I was head of languages, but I was starting to get that itch, that desire to do something new. And my head teacher came bounding across the playground and said, there's an opportunity to do a doctorate in education. And at the time, my youngest was 7 months old and my eldest was two. And something in my head, there was this little devil on my shoulder going, go on, do it, do it, do it. So yes, to cut a long story short, I ended up doing it. I did a doctorate on balancing teaching and parenthood, which was basically, you know, counselling through writing, counselling through research, writing my life. And I got into the whole writing thing, and the doctorate was really, really hard. Writing to level 8 criteria, satisfying the desires of academics at every stage. And when you get a diverse range of academics and one thinks you're wonderful and the next one thinks that they need to put red pen literally all over everything you've written. You have to reference everything with full stops and commas in the right places. So to vent, as a relief, I used to blog. So I'd go to school and I'd come home and I'd just blog. Nothing particularly controversial, just observations on the day. You know, what do you do when students behave in a certain way? How do you deal with these kinds of situations? And it was all very much, you know, something I would do with a glass of wine at 9 o'clock at night and not think much about. But there was a big women ed movement towards finding your voice at the time and being 10% braver and everything else. And there were people saying, go on, yeah, do it, keep doing it. And there were people reading it, people responding to it. And that was lovely. And then I remember exactly where I was. It's one of those moments. I was in a car park outside the doctor's surgery for a checkup. And I just checked my blog. And there was a comment saying, I'm commissioning editor from Bloomsbury Education.
Wow.
I really like your blog. Would you like to write a book for us? So I phoned my husband and said, ha, 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 very good, you got me, well done. And he said, what are you talking about? So he went off and did some research and she existed. This person existed. And I ended up, going along to the lovely Bloomsbury offices and spending a long time trying to work out what I was going to write about. And was I going to do the parenting thing or was I going to write about pedagogy or which way was it going to go? Mm. And then around a similar time, I'd moved on to a school which wasn't right for me, let's say. So, you know, I write a lot in the book about finding the right fit for you. And it was nobody's fault. It was a lovely school in lots of ways, but it wasn't the right environment for me and I wasn't flourishing. I was struggling, or I had been struggling. And suddenly that was what I wanted to write about. I wanted to write about how we actually help teachers to find the right environment for them, help them to find a voice, help them to identify schools which are right for them and help them to actually challenge those, what I came to call those toxic practices, which do actually make teachers implode, explode or walk away. So the book itself after the thesis was an absolute joy to write because I remember one of my supervisors saying, oh, you're a bit chatty, Emma, in the doctorate, and it wasn't a compliment. And I was able to just be like, look at me, I can be chatty.
And I can get someone else to do the referencing.
Yeah, exactly. And I can be as chatty as I like. So that's how it came about. It was just pure serendipity, really. Just seeing what came along, right place, right time.
Great. And for those people listening who maybe haven't had a chance to look at the book, obviously you did a large survey that forms a big part of what you then go on to write about. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found out from the survey and what was maybe one of the more surprising things that you learned from those responses?
Yeah, well, it was an interesting journey because despite the fact that I'd struggled for a few months, I was still very much, and I am still very much the stubborn optimist, but I was a little bit of a Pollyanna, you know. Yeah. I was going to basically celebrate teaching in my book, which I do. I do celebrate teaching and it's wonderful. But what happened was there was a bit of a snowball effect where I started off this survey on Twitter. I used to hate Twitter so much, but then I sort of got addicted to it, and then you know, the rest is history. I used to hate it because my husband used to treat it like a second wife and talk to Twitter instead of talking to me. Watching Game of Thrones and be frantically commenting to Twitter. Anyway, so I sent this survey out, and there was this snowball effect, and within a couple of weeks I had around 800 responses, and I was thinking this is nuts. And in addition to the responses, I was getting teachers sending me direct messages, sending me emails with these stories, and actually a lot of the stories were really genuinely horrific, shocking. You know, people on the verge of suicide, people who'd made themselves ill, people who'd been subject to some of the most humiliating, bullying experiences at work. And I suddenly realised that actually I would be an absolute fool to go in with this book of unicorns and rainbows and not to acknowledge those people's voices. And they had trusted me. They continued to trust me to share their stories with me in confidence. But I had to give those people a voice and an outlet. So I ended up changing the whole structure of the book, whereby I used to call it shining a light in the dark corners. Before I could get onto the positives and the joyful bits, I felt I needed to bring those issues out into the open, those toxic practices, the excessive workloads, the people who were saying, coming back to my original research, the people who were saying, well, you can't be a mum and a teacher. And that used to drive me nuts. Yeah. And I used to read it everywhere. Well, you can't be a mum and a teacher. You can't be a good mum and a teacher. You know, you have to choose one or the other. And these were women who in all honesty had come to believe this. I was thinking, well, what was it about the schools they were working at? What on earth was it that made them feel like that? And I felt I really needed to open up that can of worms and have a look.
I think it's interesting when you talk about balancing the need for optimism and positivity, with exploring some of those elements that I think, you know, you talk about linked to this kind of crisis in retention and losing people from the profession, which is, you know, very, very real. But reassuring to see that actually, maybe in spite of it all, a lot of people are positive about the profession as a whole and find it enjoyable. What do you think about that kind of contradiction around teaching, that people, you know, there are a lot of ways in which it's difficult, but it is still a great and worthwhile profession?
Yeah, well, that was a really interesting tension because actually, I mean, if I could just grab a copy of the book, actually the vast majority of teachers love teaching. Vast majority, around 85% of teachers. I worry for the 15, but anyway, the vast majority love being in the classroom, love teaching, love being around young people.
Yeah, it's a vocation. They've gone after it for that very reason, because that's what they love. Yeah.
Exactly. And the chapter about why teach was the easiest thing to write, because people teach for one of two reasons. They teach to make a difference in society, or they teach to share their love of the subject. Or obviously, a little bit of both.
Yeah.
So that was something I was really interested in unpicking, because actually, if you love teaching and if you see it as worthwhile, why are there 40% of teachers walking away in the first 5 years? And actually, it came down to a number of different factors. I did write something a few years ago for The Guardian saying that workload was a little bit of a red herring. I think I may have been a little bit hasty in that sense. I think workload is still a huge issue, still coming out in the research I'm currently doing on new teachers and their experiences. But I do think there's something more to be uncovered there, because no teacher minds working hard. There's no such thing as a lazy teacher. Teachers don't go in for an easy life. Well, because when I ask them, you know, do you go in for the holidays? Well, no, of course not. People aren't stupid. And actually, teachers don't mind going around in their holidays collecting data on underwater sea creatures in my daughter's teacher's case, or you know, I used to go around snapping funny French signs and things to share with my students. I never minded that kind of work.
Yeah.
If I was really into a series of lessons or really into a pile of marking, but you know what I mean. I never resented staying up till midnight doing that. It's the what I call the look I'm doing the job syndrome. Mm-hmm. So well done, you taught a great lesson. Could you just write that one up for us? Or thanks for those data headlines. Could you just put them in this different format here? Or that sort of having to evidence what you're doing, the pointless paperwork, and what one teacher called the waffly meetings.
Yeah.
The endless waffle. And you've both talked, you know, the endless waffly meetings. So those things are definitely important. But at the heart of everything I found, and it's coming out in more recent research and books that are being written, is a lack of trust and a lack of autonomy. And I think that is absolutely key, that if teachers don't feel trusted to make their own decisions, to actually know what's best for their students, then for many, many teachers, I think that can be a huge issue and a huge problem. And if they feel that someone's checking up on them all of the time, then that can bring out the reptilian instinct of just fight or flight. And that's what leads to a lot of people walking away.
Yeah. So with workload, would you say it's workload that is not directly impacting pupils? Because exactly as you say, you know, teachers are really happy to put in their absolute all and work long after their hours have finished. But it's when workload pushes into things that they don't see that direct connection with their pupils. They just feel that it's for the sake of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's that pointless work that it's, I mean, there's nothing that drives teachers more nuts than being asked to sit in a hall and be taught how to do something that they've been doing for 20 years. You have to be very careful if you're doing a whole staff differentiation, if you're doing a whole staff inset on differentiation and you've got someone there who's been teaching for 25 years, if you're not very careful, you're going to lose that person within the first 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So these one-size-fits-all staff training sessions, for example, just drive teachers insane.
Especially when teachers are the very best at differentiating. You know, they wouldn't give exactly the same piece of work to different abilities in their class. So it seems quite ironic that some teachers are being given, kind of exactly the same training if that's not the right thing for them.
Yeah, I mean, and that's not to say that we don't all need training all of the time, and that's not to say that we're not always learning, but I've seen much more effective models of staff inset. One in particular actually just springs to mind is where we actually had the TAs, the teaching assistants, each working with groups of teachers to talk about a strategy that they use with their particular student or group of students. And I think that was one of the most memorable and most powerful. It was done as a carousel. Insets that we've done, and I and it had genuine impact, whereby teachers were still using those strategies weeks and months later to great effect on the students. So it's just thinking through. Teachers hate feeling as if they're being patronised. I mean, everyone does, or as if they're being treated unfairly,
And so you've had experience, obviously, as a teacher, middle leader, and senior leader. And what kind of advice and learnings would you pass on to somebody in each of those positions, bearing in mind the kind of research that you're doing and the findings in your book?
Gosh, that's a big question.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots there, isn't there? I mean, as a teacher, I made so many mistakes early on. Don't beat yourself up over the mistakes. We're not surgeons. You know, if you're a surgeon and you mess up on the table, then obviously, you know, dire consequences. But if you're a teacher and you mess up, every day is a new day. Every day is a fresh start. We're living organisms working with other living organisms, in the words of my former boss. You know, nothing is predictable. And I think our mistake, actually, going back to that previous question, is to treat teaching as if it's something that can be managed into a structure of cause and effect and flow charts and graphs. There's nothing wrong with graphs occasionally, but when we try to push human beings into colour-coded boxes, I think we fall into a very dangerous pattern of behaviour. But so, I mean, it's just, you're human. It's Mary Myatt's line, isn't it? Mm. Human first, teacher second. Yeah. And we bang on about that all the time, but I think it's very easy to forget that. It's very easy to forget that about our colleagues when they're getting on our nerves. Mm. It's very easy to forget that about ourselves and to fall into those bad habits of presenteeism, you know, the need to be first in work, last out of work, the whole, you know, around this time of year, well, if you think you're tired now, wait till November. And we can often be our own worst enemy.
Yeah.
And I think back to some of my own working habits of, I think, how did I, you know, I've written a book on this. How did I get into these habits of, yeah, fine, get up at 6, get yourself to work for 7, but then you don't then need to stay.
Stay until 7. No, yeah. That is, and you do see that in schools. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. And you're sitting there thinking, oh, I don't know, I don't even know why I'm still here. But if I try and go home, the whole world might actually implode. But actually, and it's that common sense stuff that when we're tired, we forget, don't we? You're not thinking logically. So you forget that actually you'd be far better off to be fresh in front of your class with a basic lesson plan than haggard, broken and grey with a complex PowerPoint that frankly you could have got off any website and adapted for yourself. But we do forget, we become martyrs to our cause sometimes, I think.
So do you think it's school leaders' role to kind of set that culture and like you say, to remind their staff that they are just people and they need to look after themselves, you know, put their own gas mask on before putting the children's on? Like, do you think that is a job of school leaders? Do you think that's something that school leaders can achieve?
I mean, I think it's really important to say that I am in absolute awe of school leaders. Mm-hmm. I think they are incredible people. I think school leaders are incredible people. I, for a long time, I wanted to be a head teacher. Very recently, for the second or third time, decided that no, actually, I need to be doing something else at the moment. It's really, you know, the levels of accountability are staggering. Mm. So when school leaders don't always get it right, we can be very quick to criticise and to condemn. Mm. But actually headship, I'm learning this from my recent work with education support and so on, headship can be an extraordinarily lonely job. And when you look at the data around well-being and mental health, actually head teachers themselves are extremely vulnerable. So the first thing I'd say on that is something my former head teacher used to talk about is support upwards. Just, you know, we're very hierarchical in schools, but actually just notice, regardless of where someone is in the hierarchy, they look like they're having a little bit of a bad day. Just notice. You don't have to storm into their office and say, "What's up, Chuck?" You know, but just notice and let them know you've noticed. So I think, you know, and I've been guilty of this. I think, you know, the head teacher sets the tone, the head teacher sets the ethos. Well, absolutely they do. But the head teacher is a human being too.
They're so, also just a person dealing with a lot of the things that teachers are dealing with too.
Exactly. Yeah. And head teachers have families too, and head teachers have sick relatives too, and head teachers lie awake at night too. So coming full circle, the ideal is that, yes, as a head teacher, on a Thursday afternoon, you're leaving at 4 o'clock to take your child swimming, and that's very public and that's known.
Yeah.
That's the ideal. When the governors have summoned you because of the latest budgetary constraints, that's not always possible. Mm. So yes, it's the job of heads to set the ethos, but it's also the job of their senior leaders, their middle leaders and their main scale teachers and their support staff to support them and to offer support. They won't always accept it, but to offer support and offer just a friendly face in the course of the day. So I think we do too much leader bashing sometimes. That said, there is some real toxic leadership out there that needs to be challenged in a way that isn't being challenged yet. Ofsted seem to now be looking at staff wellbeing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is great and is a real step in the right direction. There are further steps to be taken because it's a little bit woolly. Yeah. What do they mean by unnecessary workload? What do they mean? And I would like to see Ofsted actually looking at staff turnover. Now, a healthy level of staff turnover is a good thing.
Yeah.
Always. But I would like to see Ofsted actually holding schools to account where staff turnover looks just a bit odd.
We've covered off definitely advice to teachers and senior leaders with that. And what about the person kind of trapped in the middle there, the middle leaders?
Oh, the sandwich. Well, I've been doing this job most recently, and it is indubitably the most difficult job I have ever done. Middle leader of a core subject is tough, and just hats off. If you know anyone who's doing it, just give them a hug because it is so tough. I've done it for, well, 3 years in my most recent role and a year previously. It's tough because even in the most wonderful of schools, the levels of accountability for those core subjects are astronomical. Those children need them to be able to progress to their next courses. All the other results, they're at the centre of the rest of the bundle of results and the buckets and everything else. They're worth double, as you keep getting reminded. And I am yet to see a school with a magic formula for converting fours to fives and fives to sixes and threes to fours. If there is one, please... leave a review. leave a comment.
Get in touch with us.
Tell us. But what then the risk is, and I fell into this, is that you go for some almost panicked, you know, scattergun intervention, or you're tempted to anyway, where you just want to intervene with everybody all of the time. And then you've got your staff coming in and doing lessons at 7:30, and then they're doing lessons which finish at 5, and then they're coming in on Saturday, and then they're coming in during the holidays. And then yes, with the best will in the world, they've used all of those resources, and they've used all of those resources. So what resources are they? And everyone's exhausted. And worst case scenario, talking to teachers in my research, is that the students just look at their teacher stressed out of their mind and think, well, you're doing all the stressing for me. Why should I worry? I can see you. I mean, my own class last year, I will not let you fail. It's like, you're right, miss. We've just reached this hyper accountability, hyper manic state. But advice for middle leaders, be as true to yourself and your values as you can. And it is not easy. Remember that you are human, the hardest thing to remember sometimes. Be honest about your mistakes and your mess ups and everything else. I always am probably a bit too honest, but also check in on your staff, take the temperature face to face, over email whenever you can. And this is just so shallow, but I found that Chocolate Friday had a bigger impact on my relationship with my team than anything I ever did in terms of quality CPD. I would just Friday lesson 5, nip around with a bar of chocolate for everyone, and actually it made such a difference. And if I ever forgot, God forbid. so just remember you're human, remember your staff are human, and if something is jarring with your moral compass, try and establish a buddy or someone on a similar level in your school so you can actually go and talk to them free of line management, free of judgment, and run it by them. But it's hard. It's hard because you are caught in the middle. And if anyone imagines that middle leadership is easier than senior leadership, then I can speak from experience. So it's not.
Indeed. Go and hug those middle leaders.
Yeah, give them some chocolate.
Yeah. Hug a middle leader.
yeah, get that going. And at the end of the book, you talk about some models that you know the UK teachers and the system can learn from. And so what would you say are the most important changes that could be made at that system level and at school or kind of trust level?
Well, there's the blue sky changes, aren't there, and the subtle changes. We're at the moment, we're hostages to data. So just earlier today, I drove past a school and my first thought was, oh, 2 places above us in the local league table. And that was the first thing I thought when I looked at the school. It's like, and I caught myself. Yeah. We are hostages. Now, data can be extremely valuable, but I'd like it seen more as a tool and less like a chokehold over schools. So that hyper accountability. I mean, there is a group of amazing school leaders who I've been lucky enough to meet through recent events, like Bruets, for example. Yeah. I'm going to name 2 head teachers who have absolutely inspired me and sort of because when I was writing this book, I actually found myself getting a little bit depressed at times, because you can start thinking, well, actually, it's all just gone to pot. There's nothing we can do. It's all just, you know, it's not doable anymore. And I'm an optimist. But Ray Snape and Jeremy Hannay, name checks, both have this work around this mantra that there is another way. And they do not scrutinize their staff. They do not have performance management as such. Their staff are trusted. The normal hierarchies are treated differently. Their staff stay. Those schools are flourishing and thriving and doing really well by every measure, actually. Yeah. So what I'm, you know, I'm radical, but you think of it with people like that, there's almost a grassroots movement of head teachers who are saying that actually that some of those traditional leadership courses, which teach leaders never to apologize, never to explain, you know, demand standards at all costs, maybe are a little bit outdated and that there is another way. So almost a grassroots movement of, you know, and go and visit Three Bridges, Jeremy's school, if you want to see it in action, because he always welcomes visitors.
Yeah, great stuff. And you're taking some time to do more research. Is there are there places that listeners to the podcast can see you coming up?
Yes, I am. I'm on a new journey. I'm first time in my adult life I've operated outside a classroom in a timetable from university to school, and I still look at the clock and think 3 minutes to lesson four. Oh. That's probably going to go on forever.
I was going to say, we can confirm you're functioning outside of a classroom.
Yes, it's 12:10. I better have a wee. I was in a meeting in an office the other day, and they said, do you know what, Emma, you can go for a wee whenever you like.
It feels groundbreaking, actually, but it really does.
I don't even need one, but I'm going to go now because I can. I am researching, I'm speaking, I'm writing, I'm training, I'm working with all sorts of different people. It's really exciting, very disconcerting. And yes, I do feel constantly guilty for not being preparing for lesson five at this moment. So things I'm doing, I have been doing for a while. I'm a regular columnist for the TES, so look out for my column there. I'm working on a new book we're at proposal stage, but we're optimistic, for Sage Education, which will be a very, very, very practical guide written in collaboration with Adrian Bethune a sort of handbook for teacher wellbeing. I'm working as an associate for Education Support, who are amazing. If you're struggling, please call them. They are incredible. It's free. They have counsellors. They have services like you wouldn't believe. And they are on our side, absolutely rooting for us. And I'm doing some work with the NFER as an associate as well. And just generally being a positive disruptor, in the words of Jazz. And not being affiliated to a school at the moment, although I am still teaching, I'm doing plenty of supply, means that I can just possibly agitate and shout a little bit louder than I would have done when I was directly affiliated to a school.
Fantastic. Mm, well, best of luck with all of that, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Emma.
And
pleasure.
And thank you very much for listening. Key Voices is produced by The Key, giving education leaders the knowledge to act. Members of The Key for School Leaders can access hundreds of articles on the latest issues in education at thekeysupport.com.